What I want to do at the moment is just set out what is coming your way today before I go on to look at the historical background to the referendum. The purpose of the conference is to relate the Scottish independence question to a number of issues and themes. Firstly, to Scottish-Irish relations, and especially the relationship between Scotland and Northern Ireland. That will be the primary, although not the exclusive, focus of today's event. But we'll also be relating the question to broader issues of the constitutional future of the United Kingdom, to matters of identity, particularly that of Britishness. It may sound odd coming from a Scot in a World Cup year, but I want to hear a lot about England today. Particularly the north of England, which I've always viewed as something of a cultural mediator or cultural broker between Scotland and England in sustaining the union thus far. I want to look at the Scottish question in relation to other parts of the world with comparable political and constitutional tensions, such as Canada and Spain. And also to consider possible future developments, not just in the context of these islands, but also internationally. And to do all this, I'm pleased to say that we have a range of expert speakers, and they come not only from academia but also from the worlds of politics and journalism. And I'm grateful to all the speakers for taking up the invitation to come here today in the middle of what I know are hectic schedules with multiple demands on their time. I scheduled myself for this slot with the intention of providing some historical background to today's deliberations, and I'll try to do this, if only in a rather sketchy manner, given the time limits. I will also focus mainly on the Northern Irish-Scottish dimension of what, as my title proclaims, is a tangled web of interactions and relationships across these islands as a whole. Moreover, I will also concentrate on political history. It seems to me that while the study of Irish-Scottish relations, to take that example, has enjoyed something of a flowering since the turn of the century, the political aspects of relationships such as this have not received as much attention as, for example, sub-subject areas as literature, language and the arts, and areas of social and economic history like migration and diasporas. And I think this is rather odd, given that the scholarly moment of the turn of the century that I'm referring to was essentially a political happening. Without the cessation of violence and the onset of the peace process in Northern Ireland and the constitutional shake-up of the United Kingdom, it's doubtful if the space and the opportunity for the rediscovery and reconstruction of Irish-Scottish links would have transpired. Political changes led rapidly to a reassessment and reconfiguration of relationships within these islands. And regardless of the outcome of the referendum in September, it's likely that this political happening will have a similarly far-reaching effect. The relative lack of political analysis may reflect habits that are so long established that they're extremely hard to break. And in this respect, the notion of Northern Ireland as a place apart, as sui generis, as a constitutional oddity, I think is particularly prevalent. Indeed, there is still an ingrained tendency, I would suggest, to exclude Northern Ireland from discussions and debates about devolution and the future of the UK and the Union more broadly. Notwithstanding the fact that the political reality since the turn of the century has been that of a UK characterised by governmental pluralism and institutional diversity. So I'm going to try to redress the balance by saying something about the political character of relations between Ireland and Scotland since the time of partition and since the time of the creation of Northern Ireland as a devolved entity within the UK. The settlement of the Irish question in 1921-22 had important political consequences for Scotland. It might be said that it helped Scotland to develop politically along wider British lines, to conform to a left-right and class-based political framework. And it opened up more political space for the Labour Party, in particular, to appeal across the Protestant-Catholic religious divide of West Central Industrial Scotland. And at the same time, it constrained the Conservatives from making much sectarian capital out of Irish unrest. And I should remind you that the Conservatives were known as the Unionists in Scotland from this period right up until the 1960s, just as they were known as Unionists in Northern Ireland. As it took over from the Liberals as the party of progressive politics, Labour assumed increasingly the character of an urban working class alliance throughout Britain. And it was effectively a unionist party on the constitution, maybe unionist with a small u. The relatively socially disadvantaged Irish community, largely of Catholic religious affiliation in industrial Scotland, became solidly Labour on account of the party's concern for working class welfare and its ability to satisfy the Catholic Church that it was committed to the Education Act of 1918, which had provided for full state support for separate Catholic schools. Scottish Labour had been and remained a strong supporter of land reform, but it might be said that the land question, which had been the basis in the late 19th and early 20th century for joint Scottish-Irish radicalism, saw its profile as an issue dip within the predominantly urban British political battleground of the 1920s onwards. In this sense, there was a disconnect politically between Scotland and Ireland compared to the heady days of Michael Davitt and John Murdoch. Further, that notable episode of Irish-Scottish rural radicalism encompassed the mainly Catholic nature of the land agitation in Ireland and the mainly Calvinist crofters of Scotland. As Scotland's politics increasingly were shaped around the two-party class-based structure of the Westminster-dominated world, so, therefore, much of its interaction with the new Northern Ireland was curtailed. Popular Protestant politics did register in interwar Scotland and did carry echoes of Ulster. Yet religious and cultural divisions and tensions in Scotland did not map straightforwardly onto political divisions as they did in Northern Ireland, and economic and class concerns were able to cut across sectarian appeals in a way that they could not in the province. Northern Ireland was cut adrift from British party politics, and a zero-sum orange versus green political culture afforded little room for secular appeals of any kind. It was also a major point of contrast with Ireland north and south that Scotland's own national question was politically muted between the wars. Although there were bills for a Scottish Home Rule Parliament introduced and debated at Westminster during the 1920s, they were talked out and easily diffused. And this spurred a small group of mainly culturally attuned nationalists, including the poet Hugh McDermott, to form the Nationalist Party of Scotland in 1928. However, this party's independence demands were watered down to the home rule within the empire stance of the Scottish National Party, the SNP, which was formed in 1934 after the fringe fundamentalists like McDermott had been ejected. McDermott then went off to seek inspiration elsewhere, and he and others of like mind tended to look to Ireland in a spirit of Celtic solidarity. However, as the historian and McDermott devotee Bob Purdy has demonstrated, Scottish nationalists could make little sense of the Civil War in Ireland of 1922-23 and its profound legacy for the subsequent politics of the Irish Free State. Scottish nationalist visitors to Ireland tended to see only what they wanted to see, and that was usually a kind of romantic Celtic idyll, and they ignored the rest. And again, it's important to stress how Scotland's largely social class-based political development was at variance, firstly, with Northern Ireland, where the constitutional or national question dominated politics to the virtual exclusion of all else, and secondly, with the Irish Free State, where the politics of the national question lingered in the shadow of the Civil War, and where there was a largely rural economy with no significant urban proletariat driving class politics. The Second World War saw Northern Ireland share the experience, notably the harrowing trauma of the Blitz, with the rest of the UK, while the south of Ireland remained neutral. This broadened and deepened the gulf between North and South in Ireland, a development reinforced by the extension to Northern Ireland of the Attlee Labour government's post-war welfare state reforms. Indeed, the combination of the UK's part in the defeat of Nazi Germany and the sense of a people's peace to match the people's war provided a signal boost to British identity. Notions of common sacrifice, rewarded with common social security, tightened the bonds of union. Nevertheless, there were important stirrings of Scottish national or nationalist sentiment as well as British during and after the war. And other measures of the Attlee government, most notably nationalisation, had the effect of making many Scots fearful of too much London centralisation. And it was in this context that the Scottish Convention movement, led by John McCormack, had such an impact in the late 1940s, with its national covenant in favour of a Scottish Parliament acquiring some 2.5 million signatures. What is seldom appreciated is the extent to which the Scottish Home Rule movement of the post-war era took its cue from the one existing devolved administration in the United Kingdom, namely Stormont in Northern Ireland. If Northern Ireland's political culture had developed in a very different way from Scotland's, the value of the province's devolution experiment could nonetheless be viewed as pertinent to those dissatisfied by a London-centric union. Pro-Home Rule Scottish newspapers carried flattering accounts of what were seen as the advantages of devolution to Northern Ireland. And McCormack himself led a Scottish Convention delegation to Northern Ireland for a fact-finding visit and meetings with government ministers in 1949. Coincidentally, as Scottish Home Rulers shaped their aspirations around the Stormont model, there emerged at this juncture a body of opinion in Ulster that wished to go further and become a self-governing dominion of the Commonwealth. as indeed the Irish Free State had been until a republic was declared there in 1948. And this dominion state tendency came from within the governing Ulster Unionist Party. And it was only subdued with some difficulty. The clinching argument for the status quo being that the province would not enjoy the levels of welfare support and social security recently acquired from the Attlee Labour government in any Dominion state arrangement. And over the course of the late 40s and early 50s, it was indeed notable how crucial the factor of enhanced social welfare and health provision was and would be to the continuing unity of the UK, and how relatively well both Scotland and Northern Ireland did in terms of public expenditure from the centre. By the mid-1950s, the campaign for a Scottish Parliament had come unstuck as the welfare state bedded down. The Conservatives returned to power in 1951, conceded a Royal Commission on Scottish Affairs, but it concluded by advocating only minor adjustments to the administrative devolution arrangements that Scotland possessed. And it should, of course, be noted that some scholars have argued that the accumulation of powers and responsibilities by the Scottish office during the 20th century represented a considerable degree of autonomy, notwithstanding the lack of a democratically elected assembly and the behind-closed-doors nature of this kind of governance. In the 1955 general election, the Unionists, Conservatives still were called in Scotland, won over half of the Scottish vote, which is an achievement unique to this day. And in 1958, the Scottish Council of the Labour Party felt able to drop its historic, if since the 1920s, largely theoretical, commitment to Home Rule. However, with hindsight, the apparently harmonious character which the UK assumed in the 1950s and early 60s, based on a degree of consensus politics and a more interventionist state, I think this was in a way anomalous. Because the late 60s were to see the arrival of serious challenges to the state in the form of the eruption of the Northern Ireland Troubles and the rise of political nationalism in Scotland and Wales to an unprecedented level. Now, there were important connections and interactions between these phenomena. The impact of the Northern Ireland Troubles on Scotland has been studied insufficiently, although I'm very pleased to say that two scholars who have studied it, distinguished scholars, Tom Gallagher and Ian Wood, are going to be present today and may be present at the moment. But I think it's still fair to say that we are at the early stages of an investigation into just how the Northern Ireland Troubles affected Scotland. And similarly, the impact of Scottish political developments on Northern Ireland has been completely overlooked. Yet, in separating out the Northern Ireland of Broglio as a kind of freakish, anachronistic, religious squabble that did not relate in any way to normal or mainstream Britain and British politics, I think in doing this, scholars and commentators have missed some crucial links between Northern Ireland and other parts of the UK, in particular Scotland. And they've also failed to assess properly questions of British identity and questions of how the UK has actually worked or held together, however uneasily. Let me take an example. If it's acknowledged that a substantial number of people in Britain, and of course Scotland, value an Irish heritage and background, whether from the north or south of Ireland or a Protestant or Catholic background, then it's reasonable to surmise that their sense of British identity may be qualified, shaped, complicated, bolstered, undermined, even negated by that sense of Irishness. And perhaps too by the way that the Northern Ireland conflict has been handled by the British state. And similarly, the notion of the UK as a construct with room for a plethora of national, regional and ethnic identities and a capacity to absorb conflict and tensions is strengthened and not diminished by the inclusion of Northern Ireland. And this notion may well hold the key to explaining the longevity of the UK, even as British identity appears from various surveys and indicators to be in decline. However, even if the focus is restricted to day-to-day political developments rather than broader existential identity questions, there is much to be said about the effects of the Northern Ireland Troubles from the late 1960s through to the end of the century. The Northern Ireland emergency arguably deflected the Heath Conservative government from addressing Scottish devolution in the early 1970s, while the Labour governments between 1974 and 1979 also found that the objectives of bringing political stability to Northern Ireland and bringing forward devolution schemes for Scotland and Wales often cut across each other in spite of those governments' best attempts to keep them apart. Labour's instincts in relation to constitutional matters in the 1970s were, to put it mildly, cautious. But the very limited and modest proposals that they came up with in the mid-1970s for devolution were partly the result of the government's fear of such developments rendering their task in Northern Ireland more hazardous. Equally, the failure of the Ulster Constitutional Convention of 1975-76 was to a significant extent the result of the majority Ulster Unionist demand that Northern Ireland should receive the same devolutionary scheme to be offered to Scotland and Wales. In the debate over devolution in Scotland prior to the referendum of 1979, a referendum that recorded an insufficient vote in favour of devolution, the Irish Troubles were invoked to support the arguments of both pro- and anti-devolutionists, largely by inducing fear of similar mayhem spreading to Scotland in the event either of a Scottish Assembly being denied or a Scottish Assembly being established. Tam Dalziel, for one, you know, was not afraid to make use of this type of argument against devolution. Now, the inconclusive referendum result of 1979 was quickly followed by the return of the Conservatives under Margaret Thatcher. And the long period of Tory rule from 1979 to 1997 was notable for the reassembling of the case for a Scottish Parliament as a form of popular protest against the Thatcher government. A perception, I think, grew steadily in Scotland that she and her government had little appreciation of Scottish national distinctiveness, no respect for Scottish institutions, and no grasp of the concept of the Union as a two-way street, of the tacit understandings and balancing acts that the Union had always rested upon. Now, to some extent, there has been some revisionist work about Mrs. Thatcher in Scotland by the writer David Torrance, who would dispute some of what I've just said, but it's quite clear from Mrs. Thatcher's memoirs that, certainly in her comments about the Scottish office, that she had very little patience with notions of Scottish distinctiveness. Thatcher's successor, John Major, may have attempted to repair some of the damage, but he was just as opposed to giving Scotland a devolved parliament. Moreover, as Northern Ireland moved towards peace during his premiership, Major left himself open to attack over his inconsistency in supporting devolution for Northern Ireland as part of the peace process, while denouncing devolution for Scotland. The 1990s, indeed, were years when the UK constitutional debate again brought Scotland and Northern Ireland together. At some points, it seemed that Scotland was pushing and advancing the devolutionary and constitutional reform agenda. At other points, it was Northern Ireland and the peace process that appeared to be the catalyst for demands for change and, in particular, the redress of the perceived democratic deficit in Scotland. The 80s and 90s were also crucial in the development of thinking in the Labour Party in Scotland. The party moved away from a unitary state cast of mind towards a union state line, by which I mean a reconceptualisation of the UK as a quasi-federal polity. And these were crucial years in shaping a firm and unequivocal commitment to devolution, from which Tony Blair, much though he might have liked to, could not renege when he became Prime Minister in 1997. And as the Labour Party underwent this change in mindset, it admitted Northern Ireland increasingly into its reform agenda for the UK as a whole. Within a unitary state outlook, Northern Ireland was easily marginalised. For instance, as I've noted, it was not part of the mainstream party system. Unitary state conservatives in both the Thatcher and the Major eras regarded the unitary state as comprising England, Scotland and Wales, with Northern Ireland simply an exceptional case. As the constitutional debate moved in the direction of union state ideas, propelled especially in Scotland by the Labour Party through the Scottish Constitutional Convention, which sat from 1989 to 1995, it became more difficult for Northern Ireland to be omitted from the picture. Now, it's certainly true that Scotland and Northern Ireland arrived at their devolutionary destinations by different routes. But it's nonetheless important to recognise the extent to which the two cases had for decades rubbed off each other, cut across each other, influenced one another, and finally converged around their new devolved structures and capacities, and their centrality to the future of the redefined union, with its accompanying questions of identity and allegiance. The extraordinary historical moment when peace, at least of a kind, came to Northern Ireland, and the UK was shaken up and decentralised, proved to be an auspicious one for Scottish-Irish relations. To a significant extent, old historic and cultural bonds were rediscovered, and certainly in the academic and media worlds, new relationships were formed. Indeed, there seemed to be a new fluidity and expansiveness about relationships across these islands. The potential there may have been for productive interchange and cooperation between the two devolved entities now of Scotland and Northern Ireland, I think, largely failed to be realised, partly on account of the Northern Ireland Assembly's stuttering progress in the early years, when the problematic outworking of the 1998 agreement led to suspensions of Stormont. With such thorny issues as the decommissioning of paramilitary weapons, the reform of the police, taking time to be resolved, Northern Ireland could not focus on the operation of devolution as such. And it's really only since 2007 that there has been proper continuity in terms of the functioning of the institutions. More widely, it's fair to say that since the transformation of the United Kingdom governmentally at the end of the 20th century, there have been many uncertainties and ambivalences around what is in effect a UK project in transition. And at this juncture, it's not clear where that project is heading, possibly in relation to Scotland, to an end point. The Northern Irish historian Alvin Jackson has referred to the constitutional proposition first advanced by Gladstone and still of crucial importance today, and that is the paradox that the United Kingdom could be best sustained through devolution. The Scottish referendum of 18 September this year puts this proposition to the test. The SNP's period of government, first as a minority government from 2007 till 2011, and then its astonishing Holyrood election victory in 2011, have paved the way for the vote on the question, should Scotland be an independent country? Now, the SNP, who have long been enamoured of the Irish nationalist leader Charles Stuart Parnell's declaration about no man having the right to fix the boundary of the march of a nation, plays on the teleological notion that Scotland's destiny lies in independence, that it's somehow decreed by history. Those in favour of the Union are, by contrast, faced with the apparently drier task of upholding Gladstone's proposition. They need to convince Scots that the Union is capable of evolving to meet the needs of the time. The referendum matters greatly to Ireland, North and South. The SNP have laid great stress on what its leader Alex Salmond calls the social union, the idea that independence would not in any way attenuate the deep and extensive ties between the peoples of the different parts of these islands. Politically, however, a yes vote would have far-reaching effects on Northern Ireland. A truncated UK of England, Wales and Northern Ireland would not have the same emotional resonance. Culturally and socially, much of the Northern Ireland unionist sense of belonging and sense of who they are is bound up with Scotland in particular, and the historic links across the Narrow Sea. An Ulster Scots identity has become recognised as part of the complex tapestry of the province, and central to the culture war, which some see as having replaced the guns. Some unionist politicians have entered the Scottish debate to urge Scots not to break the ties of kith and kin, and this has been something of an anguished echo of similar pleas made at the height of the Irish Home Rule crisis a century ago. The Scottish historian Colin Kidd has made the point that nationalism is an ingredient of Scottish unionism, and that most Scots have long been susceptible to both unionist and nationalist sentiments. Historically, nationalism and unionism have been two points on a political continuum in Scotland rather than binary opposites as they have been in Ireland. And it remains to be seen whether that unionist-nationalist interplay in Scotland of over three centuries is maintained, which some view as possible even in the event of a yes vote. Indeed, in such circumstances, I wonder if that creation of the Belfast or Good Friday Agreement, the British-Irish Council, with its secretariat now based in Edinburgh, could it play a key role in easing the tensions and ruptures which might accompany a Scottish departure from the UK? Well, I've wandered off into speculation, so I think I'd better stop at that point. But I hope that part of what we do today, along with appraising the current situation in the run-up to the referendum of 18th of September, is informed and imaginative speculation about a future that matters to all of us. Thank you.